We're still going through the book of Mark, like we've been doing for a bit, and we've kind of been just jumping around a little bit, but I want you to know in Lent here, we're actually going through what is the lectionary. Do y'all know the lectionary? It's this like compiled readings that people have around the world where they're reading the same things each week. Some churches preach on the same texts. And part of the reason we're doing that in Lent is because it's so easy to feel disconnected. And it's so easy to feel alone and separate. And even last week when we were meeting and Martin shared about his friend, I have this ache to be connected to folks who are in other spaces and don't have some of the privilege that I have and are experiencing victories that I'm not and are experiencing struggles that I'm not. And one of the ways that we can step towards it is at least realize like, hey, we're reading something with people who are around the world, who span the world. There's hundreds and thousands of sermons today on this text. I asked, mine comes in fourth to last, so look online for the good ones. But it's powerful that people are reading the same word. I find something really comforting in that. And so let's just take a minute and let our hearts and minds be curious with people around the world. If you have got a specific place in mind, let that be in your mind. A specific person, let that be the person in your mind, any of that. And the words are going to be on the screen, but I'm going to read our text for us here. It's Mark 9, 2 through 8. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling bright, such as no one on earth could brighten them. And there appeared to them Elijah and with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us set up three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And then a cloud overshadowed them. And from the cloud there became a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." And suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. It's a wild passage, right? There's a lot for us to just take and swallow this whole and be like, yeah. But we're going to just kind of explore it a little bit. First of all, I got to let you know that for about a week, I was a little upset that it was Mark who got to compile this. Because I think Mark missed some really interesting things. If this was another gospel according to this Matthew, I would have paid attention to things that Mark didn't pay attention to. First, how do you know that it's Elijah and Moses? You know what I mean? Like, is Elijah famous for wearing a certain yellow hat or something? And when you see the yellow hat, you're like, of course, that's Elijah. Lore has he always wore a yellow hat. Is it like a dream where you just know who everybody is? You have those dreams? Sometimes I will have a dream and somehow I know 5,000 people's names and in real life I can't remember anybody's. Or was that just something that happens in those kind of moments? Maybe it was super just very human-like. And Jesus was like, "Hey, Pete, this is Elijah. This is Moses." I don't know. I'm fascinated. If this Matthew got to compile this, we would know. I want you to know. That's the stuff that I care about. A second thing. If I was compiling this, you would know what they were talking about. Or at least you would know that I investigated everybody. And I pried for all the information I can. And I spent time trying to figure it out. And I couldn't figure it out. And so I just sat there reading this little chunk over and over again, trying to figure out what Jesus and Elijah and Moses were talking about. Because I can't sit in a coffee shop and not figure out what everybody else is talking about. I definitely want to know if it's those three. So I spent about 10 minutes deciding the three conversations that I would want to hear about. And I'm going to gift this to you. Number three, 1953, Dr. King and my good friend Howard Thurman sat and listened to the World Series. Dodgers versus Yankees, they just sat in a study and listened to the game. Tell me you wouldn't love to be in that room, finding out what they're talking about, who they're rooting for, what they're really frustrated about. That'd be a good 3 hours. Great moment. Conversation number two. I wanted to be there when somebody decided that a corn dog was a good idea. Think about this for a minute. First, somebody had to decide a hot dog was a good idea. That's really odd. And then they had to say, let's take a hot dog and put it on a stick. And this person, probably in Frankfurt, Germany, then put a bunch of cornbread on top of it and said, we're not done yet. We're going to now stick it in hot oil, and it's going to come out and taste like a state fair. And then we're going to freeze it. You can put it in the microwave, and it'll taste like regret. That would have been a fascinating conversation when somebody said that was a good idea, and everyone else said, no, it's not. And now there's millions of dollars spent on corn dogs. Three of you are going to buy corn dogs. In conversation number one, this one, I want to know, what were they talking about? What would they have been saying? Or are they just kind of nodding at each other? It doesn't seem like it's like a 12-minute or a 12-second transfiguration. It seems like they had a couple minutes. So that's where I was stuck for several days. Once I got past that, there's a few other things that stood out for me. Somehow it was known that it was Elijah and Moses. Okay, we already covered that. But it's pretty significant that it's Elijah and Moses, right? Elijah represents the prophets. You could have picked another prophet, maybe. You could have picked a more writing prophet. But Elijah's that. Moses, he represents the law, right? So we have the law and the prophets up on the mountain with the Messiah. This is right after the claim of the Messiah. These three are not equal, but probably represent a moving on to the clarity within the kingdom of God. And I love that Mark records what Peter said because he didn't know what to say. He's scared and he just kind of panics. You ever been there? Like, people have really analyzed this. Why did he want to set up three tents? Was it because they were holy people? Because he wanted to stay in that moment? Maybe. I don't know. Scholars can't agree. So I think he kind of panicked because Mark said he kind of panicked. He's like, I got to be busy doing something. Do you want somewhere to sleep? What do we do? What do you say when you see Jesus all of a sudden, like, transfigured, looking completely other? When you see people who weren't there before, all of a sudden there, what would you do? I probably would say something like, oh, can I build you a tent? I'd say something. Again, there's some significance, but it's not really agreed upon. And I find a couple other things more curious. We're going to kind of move on from it. You go further into this, and God the Father speaks directly, but not to Jesus. At the baptism, it's to Jesus, right? This is the very thing that, like, empowers Jesus, encourages Jesus, reminds Jesus who he is before he goes into the wilderness. Here we see this cloud come down on Elijah and Moses and Jesus. And then God the Father, in a voice that they could hear, speaks to Peter, James, and John. That's the audience. He says, this is my son. Listen to him. That's significant. Then the cloud and Moses and Elijah are gone. They're just gone. Well, this is kind of a turning point in Mark. N.T. Wright says that this is the point where we go from, like, a major key of music to a minor key as we go towards the cross. Makes me wonder, why does it happen at this point? Why is it this day that Jesus is transfigured? Why does Mark record it at that moment? And so we're going to look into this a bit. In the previous chapter, Jesus does one of the miracles that is probably the most confusing. He spits on his hands and he rubs the spit on a guy's eyes. It's not very sanitary. It's not recommended. At first, the guy says it looks like there are trees walking around, and so Jesus rubs some more saliva in his eyes. The guy can see. Okay. Then Jesus asks who people are saying that he is. Peter says, some say that you're Elijah. No, it's Elijah because, like, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, Elijah goes up in a chariot, right? So people are like, Elijah never died. He just went up. I don't know where he kept upping. Like any space show, you just go forever, so that'd be scary. Hopefully he caught God or something. But he just kept going. So maybe it's Elijah. Or maybe it's John the Baptist. There's real hope at this time that John the Baptist didn't die or was going to be resurrected or was that wasn't the end, because John the Baptist came before the Messiah. When it's Peter's turn, he confesses that he sees Jesus as the Christ. And then Mark continues. Catch what's next. Then Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." There's a lot in this. I'm not going to pretend to get to all of it, but there's a little bit I want to get to here. So Peter's belief is like powerful and correct, right? He sees very early that Jesus is the Christ. But everything that comes with that begins to unravel as soon as Jesus speaks. All understanding of what Jesus as the Christ meant just falls apart as soon as Jesus talks. This Messiah, this Son of Man, is going to suffer and die at the hands of religious folks. 3 days later, he's going to rise again. Mark writes that Jesus said this quite openly, something that Peter was very uncomfortable with. And then what happens? Peter pulls Jesus aside to correct Jesus on the ways of Jesus. Silly Peter. Silly me. And have you ever been there? I'm not going to make you out yourself, but have you ever had those conversations with Jesus where you're like, "Hey, I think I know what you're about, and it seems like this right here doesn't match that. Hey, I feel a little unseen. You're the one who redeems. You're the one who heals. And here I am." Now, there are times where I haven't said anything. And I just let the distance form between me and Jesus. You know what I mean? Like you may have done with a friend or somebody in your life. You didn't know how to handle it. And so you just grew distant because you just didn't talk about it. That's happened to me in my own spiritual life sometimes. I've acted like I need to be like, "Okay, you're good and you're beautiful and everything you do is wonderful, but I feel the opposite, so I'll say that," and then I'll just have this giant rift between me and you. These unspoken corrections that I have, these ways that I would do it better if I had your powers. I remember one way I used to see it is, you remember the old Super Mario Brothers? Like, if I was God, it's good I'm not, but if I was God, I think, like, sometimes when you do something silly, I would just make you small. Like Mario would have, you know, he would just be small for a little while, and then he's got to go eat a mushroom, and then he can get big again. If you do something silly, I wouldn't, like, hit you with lightning. I would just make you live little for a little bit. You get to be, like, a third the size. You got to scurry through life. It's going to be hard till you eat a mushroom. I think that's what I would do. Good, I'm not God. But at times I've had that distance, right? And I've distracted myself. I've avoided the conflict with God because I don't know how to talk about it. And sometimes it's too painful to name what I'm feeling, so I just stay apart. But sometimes I do talk to Jesus about it. I'll get out a piece of paper and draw diagrams. I'll show exactly what I think it should look like. I'll plead my case, open up other verses and show why I think it should be from the Bible even, and use every bit of research I can find to say, "Jesus, I don't think this is the way of Jesus. I think there's something other." It feels I've looked at some suffering of people so long that the messianic cure is clear. The way of Jesus is clearly to be what I've diagrammed, what I've planned. And more than once, I've needed to confess that I have tried to instruct Jesus on the ways of Jesus. My guess, by knowing us a little bit, is I'm not the only one. There are times where we feel like, hey, we could do this better. Now, what Peter does actually is a little more than that. I mean, Peter goes a whole other step. See, the Greek word for when Peter rebukes Jesus is the same as when Jesus casts out demons from people. So that's pretty strong. So he's rebuking like a demon within Jesus. And so it makes sense that Jesus says, no, you get behind me, Satan. Like, it's not Satan tempting me, it's in you. For you're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Peter rebuked the accuser. And Jesus said, it's not me, it's you. Now, I think that's important for us to know, because there have been plenty of days when somebody gives me a confession as a pastor and just says, hey, you know what, I have said, Jesus, I don't even know if you're Jesus. God, I don't know if you're good. I can't sing that song. I can't read that verse. And usually that's followed with, did I go too far? Is God now done with me? Frustrations, confusion, thinking of another way, that's one thing. Here we have Peter saying Jesus must have demons. This must be the end of their friendship. Must be the end of Peter remaining in Jesus, but it's not. It's not. Jesus explains the way of Jesus is before him. He tells the crowd the way of Jesus is taking up the cross. Everyone taking up the cross. And that clearly doesn't mean that we're all going to die on crosses. But it does include thoughts and actions that I would prefer not to have. It does involve suffering that I would rather run from. And this is the section of Scripture where Jesus says, for what will it profit then to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Man. The things we would settle for gaining even a chunk of the world, right? It's worth a pause. What would we settle for? A job? A moment of peace or distraction? National security? End of a war? An election won? If we're honest, these little buds of an easier life that pop up and appeal to us more often than we'd like to admit. These little things that we would settle for because it just feels like relief. And if you're starting to feel that Jesus was harsh, and it's better to just stay bottled up inside, better not to look at any of this, let's stick with the story here. Because in your Bibles, it's just an eighth of an inch further down, but the text says that 6 days pass between this behind me incident and the transfiguration. For 6 days, Peter, James, and John are hanging out with Jesus. For 6 days, Peter is hanging out in that space where he accused Jesus of being filled with evil, was given a glimpse of how the Messiah is going to look different than he thought, and you know, over time, how things settle, how you stew, how just it makes a difference. And it's at this point that Jesus takes these three that he's closest to, Peter included, up to the mountain. And they've just heard and chewed on the difficulty, the challenge of the way of Jesus, but all of a sudden they're going to see Jesus different. And they get a glimpse of Jesus in glory. Now it's debated whether that's resurrected glory or whether that's returning glory. Either way, Jesus radiated who he was and who he is. It reminds me of earlier in Mark when The disciples are struggling on the boat against the waves and the wind, and they're doing what Jesus asked of them, trying to get to the other side while Jesus is praying, and yet they're exhausted and tired, and all of a sudden Jesus sees them and walks on the water. It says that Jesus wants to pass them by, and we've talked about this before. And we're afraid that Jesus wants to pass us by like sneaky, like not be seen. But that's a reference to the Old Testament where Jesus is revealing who he is. No, you're struggling in the calling I have for you. You're struggling against some real stuff, some real challenges. I want you to see me. I want you to see me. And here on this mountain, after everything they've experienced, after the healing of the man without sight, after the declaration that Jesus is Christ, after the hard words of suffering and death, Peter rebuking, being corrected, transfiguration, after all of this, later they go tell about it. And the story finds its way to us almost 2,000 years later and some 6,280 miles away. And the point, I don't think, is just to marvel at the revelation of who Jesus was to these three people previously. I wonder if for this room, if it's for us to see that a misunderstanding, or even to dare correct Jesus, isn't enough to separate you. Maybe for this room, it's to see that an honest holding up of your circumstances, situations, the people you love, the inconsistency, the spaces where it doesn't look like this flourishing, abundant life is present. Maybe it's safe to bring that up before this Messiah. That doesn't get you rebuked and sent aside. That gets you a reminder that suffering is a part of the kingdom. And maybe, just maybe, that gives you also a glimpse of the glory, of the goodness, of the abundance, of the beauty of who Jesus really is. Maybe we can be courageous enough to experience Jesus again for ourselves. Somebody we can wrestle with, argue with, cry out to. Maybe we can sing the songs of God's goodness again, because we've been through it. And even if you're in the season right now that doesn't feel true, that doesn't separate you, that doesn't cast you aside. And so this week I've been praying that in some way that Jesus would meet you in a conversation, in a sunset, in a song that brings you back to memory, in a reading of the text, or in a quiet moment. And if there's any distance because you've been afraid to say what you want to say, my prayer is that you'd have courage, knowing that it doesn't disqualify you. Jesus isn't intimidated by you. And just maybe the attachment that you have is enough. Maybe he's strong enough for that too. In a moment, we're going to receive communion. Pastor Rob's going to come up and lead us in that. But I want to give you just a couple seconds to just respond within yourself. And then I'm going to pray a simple prayer, and then Pastor Rob will lead us in communion. After I pray, Wayne will bring you some elements if you need them. So let's just take a couple breaths together. Jesus, you know the ways that we have tried to teach you the ways of Jesus. And the simple way to move past that unhealed is to just say, we're sorry. But the more honest way, the more sincere and relational way is to say, Jesus, we need you. This kingdom that you're all about, we need it. This flourishing and healing and restoration and joy and hope and all of these things, we want that. And our pointing at places in time and on the map and in our lives, that's our way of saying these are the places that we desperately need to experience you. And it's scary to ask, but we ask. Would your kingdom come and your will be done right here in these places as it is in heaven? And may we see you. And may we have the courage to follow you. In your name. Amen.